At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
It's the last Monday in June, which means the Supreme Court is clearing its desk before vacation, and so two rulings from the justices today. Also, what happens when the Amish get rich? And believe me, they do. And don't look now, but Facebook wants to know how you're feeling. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. Monday, the 30th of June. Good as always to have you with us, everybody. It was a busy last day of the term at the Supreme Court today. A couple of cases of interest for us, business and economy-wise, both 5-4 decisions, by the by. Case number one, known in the shorthand as Hobby Lobby, after the Oklahoma City-based crafts company that was the lead plaintiff. The justices ruled that closely held businesses, and that is the operative phrase here, closely held businesses, cannot be forced to provide insurance coverage for contraception if doing so violates the owner's religious beliefs. From the healthcare, but this is actually a corporate structure story desk at WHYY, Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein gets us going.
The question in front of the Supreme Court was fairly straightforward. Can Hobby Lobby and other businesses be forced to offer contraception coverage if that contraception, like the morning after pill, violates their religious beliefs? The court ruled for companies that look a lot like Hobby Lobby, they don't have to offer that coverage. In writing for the majority, Justice Samuel Alito went out of his way to focus on certain businesses, says Duke Law professor James Cox.
The justice was fairly clear in saying he's talking about a closely held, family-dominated corporation with no outside owners and no diversity of opinion.
It's not clear how many businesses meet that definition. Some 9 out of 10 corporations are closely held, everything from mom-and-pop shops to giants like Koch Industries and Cargill, which employs hundreds of thousands. The bright line the court draws is about religious intent, and George Washington Law professor Robert Tuttle says you can see the difference between a family-run operation and IBM with its army of shareholders.
It's just really hard to see how they can have a sincere religious objection to anything.
While this verdict is aimed at a class of corporation, Boston College's Kent Greenfield, who filed an amicus brief in the case, expects companies of all shapes and sizes to squeeze through this new opening.
This gives companies the opportunity to ask for a waiver from regulation, and usually regulation costs money. And if they can avoid those costs by asserting a religious waiver, then they will.
Greenfield says this decision could give certain companies a competitive advantage on the basis of religion. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
Case number two from the court today, lest you'd think I'd forgotten, was a relatively narrow holding about some kinds of public employees, home health care workers specifically, and whether they can be forced to pay union dues. The short answer is no, but remember, a relatively narrow holding from the justices today. All right, moving on. 1 month to the day after Eric Shinseki resigned as Secretary of Veterans Affairs, President Obama has announced his replacement. Somebody you've heard mentioned before on this program, in point of fact, Bob McDonald, the former CEO of Procter & Gamble. Yes, that Procter & Gamble, the world's biggest consumer products company, from which McDonald retired about a year ago. McDonald did serve in the Army. He's a West Point graduate, in point of fact. But unlike a lot of his predecessors at the VA, he didn't spend his career in the military or in government service. Marketplace's David Gura reports.
In the 90s, Alan Simpson chaired the Senate Committee on Veterans Affairs, and he praises President Obama for picking someone from the private sector.
Oh, that's big. It's huge, and it's critical.
Simpson says the VA needs a proven manager. In the past, the department's been led by generals, a colonel, and a congressman, in addition to lobbyists and lawyers. But Ed Dorn says the move from business to government can be tough. He's a former Undersecretary of Defense.
A cabinet secretary is going to be held accountable by 535 people, senators and members of Congress.
A group that's many times bigger than any corporate board. And Dorn adds, corporate directors can't convene press conferences to score political points. There's also pressure from veterans groups. Barbara Romzek's the dean of the School of Public Affairs at American University.
It's a much more complicated arena to work in.
President Obama's choice caught many by surprise. Philip Longman's a fellow at the New America Foundation. He's written a book about the Department of Veterans Affairs.
On its face, this candidate has zero qualifications to head the VA.
McDonald has no background in public administration, Longman points out, and no experience in healthcare management, something Sarah Singer teaches at Harvard.
I think the VA has a very hierarchical culture, and what they need is a much more open, learning-oriented, team-oriented culture.
That is something a leader from the private sector may be able to deliver more easily than someone who spent a career in government or the military. In Washington, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
One word before we move on, brand loyalty. All right, wait, that's two, but you know where I'm going here. That's about the only thing I can come up with to explain GM's share price and sales, for that matter, not disappearing into some black hole. General Motors announced another big recall today, 8.4 million cars worldwide. I've honestly lost count how many that is total. Investors barely noticed. The major indices were kind of quiet as well. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. There are, plus or minus, a million rent-stabilized apartments in New York City. Those rents don't stabilize themselves, of course. That task falls to the New York City Rent Guidelines Board, a politically appointed group that has just raised rents by the lowest amount, that is, the smallest increase ever. The reasonably new mayor of New York, Bill de Blasio, has promised to build 200,000 affordable housing units in the next 10 years in that city, both of which reflect growing strain on renters, not just in New York, but across the country, especially in the big cities and especially among the poor. Marketplace's Bree Benishore has that story.
February was in some ways a very good month for Gerardo Odigi. He'd been in a drawn-out custody battle. It had been messy, but it had finally ended, and most importantly, he was reunited with his kids. But there were just a few logistics to work out.
Five kids, one-bedroom apartment. And I put the guests on the bedroom, then I let the boys sleep on the living room, then I sleep on the floor. So everybody's coming down to sleep with daddy on the floor. Nobody wants to sleep on the bed.
Since his kids arrived, Odigi has been looking for a two- or three-bedroom place in his area of Brooklyn.
They usually ask for about $2,000. You know, I cannot even afford that right now.
And actually, he can't afford his current apartment now either. The rent is a little over $1,000 a month, half of his annual income. He quit one of his jobs and cut his hours at the other so he could be with his kids, take them to school, therapy, the doctors. And now he's 4 months behind on rent. He's in housing court, on the verge of getting evicted. His kids are going to go live at his church for a while.
My 11 years old just told me, Daddy, why are we keeping on moving? He said, we're tired. You know, I'm doing my best to take care of my children.
People like Odigi, people on the edge, show up at Judith Goldner's office all the time. She's an attorney with the Legal Aid Society, and she says there have been more and more such people over the past 5 years.
We see all the time people having to make really terrible choices between, do they feed their kids? Do they buy medicine for their kids? Do they buy clothes? Or do they pay the rent? The rents just keep on creeping higher and higher.
And in some cases, landlords have tried to push lower-income renters out.
Sometimes we see landlords who cut off services, take people to housing court even if they don't owe any money, telling people that they don't have the right immigration status and so they have to leave or they'll call INS. You know, all kinds of bullying.
It is not simply that rents are creeping higher and higher. It is that renter incomes have fallen since the recession.
Renter households are just being squeezed more.
Max Wesselkautsch directs the Mullis Institute for Affordable Housing Policy at NYU. Last year was the first year more than half of all households in New York City were rent burdened, meaning they pay more than a third of their income in rent. The numbers are worse in L.A. and Philadelphia.
The largest increases in the share of households that are rent burdened actually happening at the moderate and middle income level.
The forces behind all of this are, it turns out, fairly simple: supply and demand.
There's been very little new production of housing. And even though new housing construction has begun to rebound in 2012 and 2013, it's still at lower levels than we've seen since at least 1960.
During the recession, people made less money. People built fewer places to live. But after the recession, people are still here. In fact, there are more of them, and they still need places to live. Many are moving to big cities, 200,000 to New York City alone in the last 3 years, adding even more pressure.
This is kind of just a classic economic problem.
It's not like cities haven't tried to address the problem. Many cities offer developers incentives to build temporarily affordable units, though many of these agreements are expiring now. Then there's rent stabilization. For 34% of rental units in New York, a politically appointed board determines how much rents can rise each year. Several cities do this. Many landlords do not like it.
To try and micromanage the increases each year is ludicrous.
Frank Ricci is with the Rent Stabilization Association. He represents residential building owners who, he says, suffer when they can't raise rents by as much as they'd like.
When you own a building, there are big expenses that pop up from time to time. Could be the roof, could be the boiler, you don't know what it is. But when big things break, they cost a lot of money. There's just numerous distortions within the whole system of rent regulation.
His opponents point out that landlord incomes have been rising faster than operating expenses for nearly a decade. Whether the most relevant distortion is the effort to control the rental market or the unhinged supply and demand behind it isn't much matter to people like Gerardo Odigi, who is still desperately trying to find a place to live for his family. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
You think about the Amish, the Pennsylvania Dutch they are sometimes called, and you think horse and buggy, traditional farming, and what a simple life, I guess, right? That's not wrong by any means. It's just not the whole picture, as Jen Banbury writes in the current issue of Bloomberg Businessweek in a piece called What Happens When the Amish Get Rich. Jen, it's good to have you with us.
Thanks.
The Amish, it turns out, are capitalists in the truest sense of the word. They are prosperous and they're doing well.
That is absolutely true. But I should point out, it's really also very new for them. This has all happened within the last three decades or so, this massive shift from agriculture to business. And it turns out they're great businessmen. Yeah.
What has happened? What's the foundation of their prosperousness?
Well, they get into a lot of business that they've historically done well with. They actually are great woodworkers, like you see the barn raising and witness. They're fabulous carpenters, so they do a lot of contracting. And they just have this incredibly driven work ethic. They keep their overhead low. There are certain other advantages. For instance, if it's a purely Amish-run business, they don't need to pay Social Security. They also don't collect it down the road. So they get to keep a lot of what they make.
Those vows of simplicity are not vows of poverty.
No. And that actually came as a surprise to me. You think because they're plain, they take some kind of vow of poverty. That's not true at all. The Amish love to make money, just like anyone, really. We all like making money. And they're just like us on that front. And, yeah, they're doing it well.
And you see when you go down there, as you talk about in this piece, when you go down to Pennsylvania and great places like Bird in Hand and places like that, you see the trappings of it. You see iPhones. You see buggies with, what was it, plush velour seats and cup holders and stuff?
Mm-hmm. That's right. I love the cup holders and the buggies. Yeah, and you see these Amish houses that are I definitely do not want to say McMansions, but they are surprisingly large for an Amish house. In fact, the only reason you know that they're an Amish house is because you don't see any power lines connecting them to the grid. But they are big, big houses.
But just because they don't use power doesn't mean they don't use the internet, for instance, right? I mean, they've got iPhones and email and...
Yeah, you know, they're allowed to do a lot of things that are business-related that they're not allowed to do that are home-related. For instance, they're not allowed to have a phone in the home. In the past, a lot of times, Amish have even had these funny little, like, outhouse little shacks that have a phone in them. Hmm. But cell phones are really confusing that issue because so many Amish have a cell phone for business. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I see these guys talking on the phone a lot, and they're not always talking about business. And, I mean, it's this slow creep of technology that they themselves acknowledge is kind of terrifying because it is so radically changing them.
I wonder, and maybe this is false romanticism, I don't know, but is there a sense of, among, I guess, probably the older Amish, that things are just changing too fast?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, this is, I would say, like the number one crisis that the Amish are facing right now. Things are changing so fast. There, you know, there are all these Amish millionaires where 30 years ago that did not exist. They don't know how to deal with money, how to deal with technology, and they're trying, really struggling, to integrate it into their life in a way that does not destroy the essence of their Amishness,
yeah.
But they're absolutely changing. There's no question they're changing. And the question is, how far are they going to go?
Yeah. Jen Banbury, she writes about the Amish in the current edition of Bloomberg Businessweek. It's called What Happens When the Amish Get Rich. Jen, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you so much. It was nice to talk to you.
Coming up,
we're sending all the wild stuff abroad, and we're importing all the farm stuff.
There is something fishy in seafood, gang, but first, let's do the numbers. All right, here you go. The Dow Industrial started the week and ended the first half of the year on a tepid note, slipped 25 points, did the blue chips a 10th percent, 16,826. The NASDAQ fared a bit better, up a 0.25%. Today finished at 4,408. The S&P 500 ended things basically flat, down less than a 10th percent, finished at 1960. The video camera maker for the extreme sports enthusiast GoPro just keeps on going, up another 13% today, meaning the stock has launched itself 50% above its IPO price last week. That is 50% higher. Not bad day for the banks and the financials. Bank of America, JP Morgan Chase, and Goldman Sachs all finished in positive territory. One of the most actively traded stocks today, Apple, jumped nearly a full percentage point on a day with rumors about new iPhones, iPads, and even the iWatch. You're listening to Marketplace. Marketplace is a nonprofit, listener-supported program, and your support in any amount helps us keep on telling the stories behind the business and economic news of the day. So please help us end our budget year strong by giving at marketplace.org by June 30th.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on construction spending for May. It's the first business day of July. Automakers are scheduled to report sales for last month. And finally, July is National Hot Dog Month. According to the National Hot Dog and Sausage Council, Los Angeles beats all other cities for hot dog consumption. I am filled with pride. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. Hard as this may be to believe, Facebook has gone and done it again, used what it knows about its users, which is plenty, in a way that said users find objectionable. There was news over the weekend that the data people at Facebook did a study a couple of years ago, basically tracking people's moods as they were on the site. They wanted to see how positive or negative posts in somebody's timeline would impact the way that person behaved. Social contagion is the term of art for that, and it goes some way to explaining why Facebook cares so much about how we're feeling. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson has that story.
If my posts were all about my great new job or awesome vacation, my friends might start feeling sad and left out. Or that's what Facebook's data science division feared. The study actually found positivity breeds positive posts and vice versa. That may sound obvious, but it's an important finding for Facebook.
Facebook's entire business model is built around data, around understanding the data, and to a certain extent, manipulating the data.
Stephen Cobb is a researcher with the security company ESET. He says the work of the data science division is key to monetizing what users reveal about themselves when they're on the site. And that's especially important now, as people's connection to Facebook may be waning. Karen North is a professor of digital and social media at USC's Annenberg School.
Anecdotally, it looks like in the United States, people are dropping off in their engagement or their amount of activity on Facebook.
Happy people might spend more time on the site, interact with it more, and maybe shop more too, says Carl Howe with the Yankee Group.
If I can make you feel really good when you're watching my ad, for example, that you're more likely to engage with that product, you're even more likely to buy that product.
Howe says in this big data age, lots of digital companies and retailers do research on their users. Facebook's mistake appears to have been that it failed to ask users for their consent. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
Listeners and or subway riders in New York City might have noticed ads of late reminding us that starting a month from now, July the 30th, workers can start using earned sick leave. So says a new law expanding sick leave to about 500,000 more workers in that city. Sally Herships has the so what.
Workers of New York, how are you feeling?
I'll wait to get sick until July 30th.
Ellen Bravo is with Family Values at Work, a nonprofit that supports workers' rights.
No, what we're going to see is fewer people going to work sick and making coworkers and customers sick.
Workers treat sick days like insurance. They save them for when they really need them and often use less than they earn. So come July 30th, do not expect a sick day bubble. That's according to Sherry Lewant. She's with Better Balance, a nonprofit that does legal advocacy for working families.
Workers save them. They save them because they know they're going to maybe need them to take care of their kids or take care of themselves if they get sick, and they don't want to waste them.
New York City estimates there are about 500,000 employees who had no paid sick time before the new law. Andrew Ritchie is executive director of the New York State Restaurant Association.
Do you get sick days?
Yes, I do.
Ritchie says restaurant owners understand that people get sick and they want to take care of their teams, but that the new policy does present challenges.
There's some office jobs where if someone comes in sick, they'll come in the following day and their work will be there on their desk. But if you're working in a restaurant and you're short a line cook, you need to bring in an additional line cook.
Ellen Bravo says from a business perspective, sick days make sense. They're much cheaper than spending the thousands of dollars it costs to replace even low-wage workers. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Consider this for a second as I set up this next interview about the American seafood industry. We control more acres of productive ocean than any other country on the planet. More water acreage that we could use to fish and harvest other seafood, to take it a step further, than all the dirt we have set aside to raise beef, pork, and chicken. And yet, says Paul Greenberg in his new book, American Catch, the idea of local seafood in this country has all but disappeared from the economy. Paul, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much, Kai. Good to be here.
I want you to tell me about that morning in 2005. You had just moved down to Lower Manhattan. You go for a bike ride over to fill in the blank.
Yeah, so it was 05. I had moved in right next to Ground Zero, a very depressing place full of banks and brokerages. Yeah. So I got on my bike and I started riding down towards East River, and I stumbled upon the Fulton Fish Market. But a few months later, I took another bike ride with the idea of coming down to the same market, and it was gone.
Gone. Banished to the outer reaches of the Bronx, right?
Banished to the Bronx. In fact, when I went to visit the old fishmongers up there, one of them said to me, you know where they put us? Right here. And he stuck his hand in his armpit. So clearly...
Oh, man.
They right, feel well, they have...
That's a little harsh, but the symbolism applies here, right? It is emblematic and symptomatic of what is happening, you say, with the seafood industry in this country.
Absolutely. I mean, we have gone from a country that was pretty self-reliant as far as seafood is concerned to one where more than 85% of the seafood we eat is imported. And it's totally reflected in the seafood marketplace. 25 years ago, something like 80% of the seafood trade was handled by individual fishmongers and fish markets. 20% was supermarkets. Now it's almost entirely reversed. Most people meet their fish at the supermarket.
You tell the story of this change in this book with three pieces of seafood, the sockeye salmon from Bristol Bay, Alaska, the Louisiana brown shrimp from down in the Gulf of Mexico, and then the eastern oyster from obviously the East Coast and New
Yes.
York. Pick one. Tell me about the change and then tell me why it matters, why it's important.
Well, the biggest change is really the swapping of oysters for shrimp. Once upon a time, we brought in about 2 billion pounds of oysters a year, and we could bring in all those oysters because the water was clean enough to let us farm them. Oysters live by filtering the water. In the last 100 years, we've seen the oyster industry plummet to about 1% of its historical capacity, and what's come in to replace that is the shrimp cocktail. We've lost our natural productive estuaries, and we've traded them for foreign estuaries.
Aren't we exporting any fish? I mean, who overseas eats our stuff?
Yeah, well, it's pretty nutso because we export about a third of what we catch.
Huh.
Primarily, it's Alaska. Alaska sends tons of salmon. In fact, we actually send almost as much salmon abroad as we import. The only thing is we're sending all the wild stuff abroad, and we're importing all the farm stuff.
Or to put that another way, we're exporting all the expensive stuff, we're importing all the cheap stuff, right? So I can go to Costco and get salmon for $2.99 a pound or whatever it is.
There is some truth in that. Like the McDonald's fillet of fish is made out of a fish called a pollock, and we catch, you know, hundreds and hundreds of millions of pounds of these fish a year. But most of it goes abroad. And in exchange, we get back farmed tilapia and farmed Pangasius catfish from Vietnam that is, you know, sort of like the cheap fillet of fish sandwich that you see in the sort of down market restaurant chains all around.
Seems to me it's an environmental story as well as a fish market economy story.
It is an environmental story, but food and environment are interlinked in a really, really
yeah.
profound way. And when suddenly we're eating from waters that are not next door, what do we do to our waters? We really let them go to pot. That said, it is not all doom and gloom. Since the Clean Water Act was passed in the early 70s, we've seen a market improvement in water quality. But the problem is we've turned our markets around so much that we can't even really seem to figure out how to get our own fish back onto our plates.
Paul Greenberg, his most recent book is called American Catch, The Fight for Our Local Seafood. Paul, thanks a lot for your time.
Thank you, Kai.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note on the way out today, in which BNP Paribas, the big French bank, comes up the big loser. Late this afternoon, we learned, as has been much rumored of late, that BNP will pay, and this is a quote, global money penalty of $8.9 billion in a guilty plea that settles charges by U.S. authorities that violated American sanctions on Sudan and Iran, among others. But wait, there is more. The bank will also be banned from doing certain U.S. dollar-denominated transactions for a full year. That, I'm here to tell you, is going to be bad for business. Think of, just as an example, oil trades. Oil denominated in dollars. All right, we're done. That is Marketplace on this Monday. The Dow Industrials off 25 points today, about a 10%, 16,826. The NASDAQ up a quarter percent, 4,408. The S&P 500 basically flat, 19.60 there. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bonner, Tommy Andres, Daisy Palacios, and James Kim. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.